Ukrainian president says Russian forces destroyed critical infrastructure in Kherson before fleeing, adding that local authorities are working now to stabilize the city. Thousands of anti-government demonstrators in Albania gathered just outside the prime minister's office in the capital, Tirana, to protest the cost of living crisis. And Iranian and Russian presidents seek to deepen political, trade, and economic cooperation. Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, the Ukrainian president says Russian forces destroyed critical infrastructure in the southern city of Kherson before pulling out their forces from the area.
As of this evening, the defense forces have established control in more than 60 settlements of Kherson region. The police have also started stabilization measures. Stabilization measures are also ongoing in Kherson. Our explosive experts have a lot of work everywhere in the free territory. Almost 2,000 explosive items have already been removed. Mines, tripwires, unexploded ammunition. Before fleeing from Kherson, the occupiers destroyed all critical infrastructure, communications, supply, water, heat, and electricity.
Zelensky said the extremely fierce fighting is now going on in the Donetsk region in the east of Ukraine. The Russian military ordered a pullout of Kherson Thursday. The Russian commander in Ukraine said it's no longer possible to keep supplying the city. And Kherson is one of four regions in Ukraine that Moscow annexed in September. Earlier, our correspondent, Johnny Miller, who is covering the war in Ukraine, gave us more details regarding the situation in Kherson. Here he is.
I think it's important to point out that it may be very dangerous for any pro-Russians still left in the city. Russia has made a point of evacuating over recent weeks pro-Russian civilians outside Kherson. They've learned the lessons in what happened in Kharkov a couple of months ago. Where there were reports of pro-Russians being killed by Ukrainian soldiers when they took over the region. I've just watched a very gruesome video of which purports to be Ukrainian soldiers executing a Russian soldier with a hammer. Obviously, there's many Ukrainian soldiers who've lost their lives trying to take back Kherson. The vengeful nature of soldiers on the front line is well documented in warfare. And also, there's a huge hatred of Russians now in Ukraine. So there's a fear, and I've seen another video of mistreatment of someone who is said to be a pro-Russian, captured by Ukrainian soldiers in Kherson, being mistreated. So anybody who's said to be or accused of being pro-Russians might be in a very difficult situation in Kherson right now. We also expect many Western media outlets to come into Kherson soon. Ukraine says that they are documenting Russian abuses of power there. So there is a fear also there might be a propaganda campaign in Kherson to stir up more hatred of Russia, which will, of course, promote more war in Ukraine rather than promote both sides going to the negotiating table.
Thousands of Albanians have gathered outside the Prime Minister's office in the capital, Tirana, to demonstrate against the rising cost of living in the Balkan country. A protest was organized by the opposition Democratic Party of Albania. People gathered in the capital to rally against soaring prices and denounce the government's policies. Now, earlier this year, the government had introduced some measures for fiscal relief. However, Albanians don't find it to be enough to alleviate the rising cost of living. Based on national statistics, a third of Albanian citizens are now living below the poverty line, and many complain the high prices are too hard to bear. Costs of food, fuel, and energy have increased amid the Ukraine war. The German capital, Berlin, has witnessed a protest against inflation triggered by soaring prices. During our news review program, we discuss how the future will look for Germany's energy sector. And I welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Okay, we have basically there have been protests throughout the German capital due to the rising cost of living, a crisis, and inflation has soared to 70-year high in Germany. Joining us now for the program is Paul Sheldon Foote, Professor Emeritus of the California State University, Irvine, California, and Mark Thornton, economist, joining us from Alabama. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program now. I guess, Professor Foote, we'll start with you, sir. Your initial thoughts on when you have one of the strongest, if not the strongest, Eurozone economy falling on such tough times. What does that mean for the rest of Europe, and what does that mean going forward?
It's very alarming. The problem in Germany is, with a parliamentary system of government, they have to form coalition governments. Last year, the Green Party got 14.8% of the vote, came in third place. No one had a majority. And so if you are a politician in Germany and you're trying to govern, you have to look around among the minor parties and say, who do I want in my coalition? Do I want to take these climate extremist nuts or someone else? So it's a very rough situation. So Germany politically is very fragile because they have these kind of people in government. And then you've had the blockages recently of the roads. People can't get to work. They can't get to hospitals thanks to these extremists. And 2 years ago, you had the German farmers by the thousands out protesting, saying, you're going to close us down because of your new environmental rules. Well, how can people complain about food prices if they caused it to happen? As long as you keep voting for the Green Party in Germany, you deserve every bit of this.
Thank you, Professor. And Mr. Mark Thornton, welcome to the program. Sir, your initial thoughts on the basically soaring inflation that we're seeing basically worldwide, but how it's impacting Germans and Germany and what that means when you have the strongest, as I mentioned earlier, economy in Europe in tatters like this.
I agree with our other guest that Germany is unstable and climate extremists are really hurting the average person, their pocketbook, their food table, their fuel, everything. And there are a lot of reasons for inflation, but it's not just one country. It's most countries in the world now are experiencing 10% plus inflation, and ultimately that has to go down to what's been happening at central banks. The Federal Reserve has enormously increased the money supply in the United States. The European Central Bank has done even more along with the Bank of Japan. So some of those leading central banks have been emitting enormous amounts of paper money, and prices are going to rise. Now, sometimes they rise in the stock market and everybody's happy, but eventually that money has to be spent. That's what's happening now. It's coming up against shortages or scarcity in terms of grain products, in terms of fuel products, and that's exacerbating. But the basic problem is too much money, and it's driving up the prices of just about everything I see, and it's happening around the world. So the Germans, you know, they may not be hungry today, but they're worried about being hungry tomorrow. They're worried about heating their homes this winter. They're worried about getting cut off from natural gas and not having, because of the German government, not having enough coal-fired energy and the shutdown of their nuclear reactors. And so the government is working against the people, whether it's the legislature or the central banks. They've all been trying to have things the way they want them personally by just printing up money to pay for everything. And, you know, you just can't do that. Eventually, you're going to face higher prices. And when people get hungry, or when people are afraid of getting hungry or cold, they're going to go out and protest. And so, you know, a lot of the times people are protesting their governments, but they also need to realize that the central bank, no matter how independent or dependent they are on the government, they're a big, big part of the problem.
Gentlemen, time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Professor Paul Sheldon Foote, Professor Emeritus, joining us from Cal State University, Irvine, California, and Mr. Mark Thornton, their economist, joining us out of sunny Alabama. And that brings us to the conclusion of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Now, Yemen is facing an acute shortage of medical supplies as a Saudi-led coalition is impeding all sorts of imports by continuing its blockade on the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports out of Sana'a.
The Yemeni Ministry of Health and Population held a press conference in Sana'a to highlight the impact of the continued Saudi siege on the national drug supply program. The event took place amid a severe shortage of necessary medication in the war-torn country.
The Saudi blockade imposed on the national drug supply program has caused one of the world's worst crises in the health sector. Medicines do not arrive on time at all due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history.
Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new airstrikes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin have placed emphasis on deepening political and economic ties. The Kremlin says the two discussed a number of issues over the phone. They stress advancing cooperation in political, trade, and economic fields, including transport and logistics. The phone call came shortly after a senior Russian security official met with Iranian officials in Tehran, where the two countries pledged closer ties. Now, Bahrain has held parliamentary elections in an environment that human rights groups have described as political repression. The Manama regime has dissolved main opposition groups and cracked down on dissent for years. Restrictions have prompted calls by Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, to boycott the elections. Now, rights groups say the ban on opposition candidates means elections will bring no meaningful results. The London-based Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy has described the vote as a sham, but the government insists elections are democratic. A government spokesperson says nobody penalized for choosing not to vote and that the elections have seen more candidates than ever. Vote is held for the 40-member lower house of parliament. Now members of the upper house are all appointed by the king. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the world has failed Myanmar amid ongoing bloodshed in the country. Guterres also called on the junta to stop the country's unending nightmare and to get the democratic transition back on track. He made the remarks in a presser at the summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Myanmar was heavily discussed at the summit. The ASEAN has spoken of little progress on a 5-point consensus agreed to last April. ASEAN leaders also issued a warning to Myanmar to make measurable progress on peace or risk being barred from the bloc's meetings. Myanmar's junta slammed its exclusion from the summit as one-sided and malicious. Now, Myanmar spiraled into bloody conflict in 2020 when the military disputed election results and ousted Aung San Suu Kyi's civilian government, killing scores of people in the process. Now, a newly announced peace deal between parties of the Ethiopian civil war seems to be making some headways. Now, both sides have agreed to lay out a roadmap for its implementation. Both sides say that they are committed to its implementation as the only way to restore peace and stability. Peace deal was signed between the Ethiopian government and Tigrayan forces earlier this month. It halted a two-year conflict that's killed thousands and displaced millions in the Horn of Africa country. Truce will boost efforts to resume much-needed aid deliveries to the northern Tigray region. Although the peace deal is a major breakthrough, it is received with some degree of caution. This is not the first ceasefire in the conflict. A previous one was breached back in August, just months after both sides committed to it. Now, in the U.S., control of the chambers, both chambers of Congress, hangs in the balance as a voting, or vote counting, that is still underway following Tuesday's midterm elections. In the race for the Senate, Democrats are one seat away from a majority. Incumbent Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada is ahead of Republican Adam LaSalt with 800 votes. And if she wins the vote, her party will control half of the Senate's 100 seats. And with one seat already allocated to the U.S. Vice President, by law, Democrats can have a majority control. And in the race for the House, it's still unknown which party will hold a majority, having already won, though, 211 out of the 435 seats. Republicans are ahead of the Democrats, but returns are still flowing in several states, including California, which will possibly give Democrats a chance to win that majority. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have warned of rising risks and the real risk of global recession. The IMF and the World Bank have also repeatedly emphasized that the global economic recession has intensified in recent months, and some countries are bound to face a recession in the coming year. The International Monetary Fund said the crisis in Ukraine, disruption in the supply chain, issues related to the supply of gas and oil from Russia to Europe, Western sanctions against Moscow, and the continuation of coronavirus pandemic quarantines in China affect economic activities around the world. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more. The International Monetary Fund has told central banks to stay the course in their fight against inflation, despite warning that a third of the global economy will be in recession next year. In its half-yearly update, The Washington-based International Monetary Fund said the worst was yet to come. It cited a combination of cost-of-living pressures, Russia's special operation in Ukraine and a slowdown in China as important factors behind the fresh economic growth downgrade. Pierre-Olivier Gourinchasse, the IMF's economic counsellor, said storm clouds were gathering but insisted central banks needed to maintain their laser focus on defeating inflation or risk the need for even tougher action later if upward price pressures become embedded. The United States, the European Union and Britain have reported inflation reaching levels not experienced since the early 1980s. And Pierre-Olivier Gourinchasse said price pressures were proving quite stubborn. He added, "The risk of monetary, fiscal or financial policy miscalibration has risen sharply at a time when the world economy remains historically fragile and financial markets are showing signs of stress. The U.S. central bank, the Federal Reserve, has raised interest rates by 0.75 percentage point at its last three meetings, while the Bank of England has raised borrowing costs from 0.1% to 2.25% since last December. The International Monetary Fund's half-yearly World Economic Outlook estimates that the global growth will slow from 6% in 2021 to 3.2% this year and to 2.7% next year in 2023. The prediction for 2022 is 0.4 percentage points lower than 6 months ago, but unchanged on an updated forecast made back in July. For 2023, economic growth has been downgraded by 0.9% since last April and by 0.2 percentage points since last July. The outlook for 2023 is weaker for 143 countries, representing 92% of global output, than it was 6 months ago. Gourinchasse said in the World Economic Outlook Forward, more than a third of the global economy will contract in 2023. While the two largest economies, the United States and the European Union, will continue to stall. Gourinchasse added, "In short, the worst is yet to come, and for many people, 2023 will feel like a recession." Germany and Italy, both heavily reliant on Russian energy, are expected to experience shrinking of their economies next year, by 0.3% and 0.2% respectively, while France is expected to post economic growth of just 0.7%. Sputnik News Agency has more on the same story. The Italian National Institute of Statistics, or ISTAT, reported 1 in 4 Italians is currently at risk of poverty or social exclusion, as the economic situation has been worsening in the country with each passing day due to inflation and increasing electricity and food prices. According to Italy's National Statistical Office, for comparison, the figure was 25.4% in 2021. Married couples with children are now at the highest risk. The most acute situation is observed in families consisting of 5 or more members. In such cases, the statistical indicator stands at 38.1%, after an increase by almost 2% in 1 year. Massimiliano Donna, the head of the National Union of Italian Consumers, called the data published by ISTAT dramatic and shameful. Massimiliano Donna said, "This already alarming and explosive situation is doomed to worsen further in 2022 due to increased utility bills and higher prices. In fact, skyrocketing inflation is an invisible tax that hits the poorest groups of society first and foremost. In this case, given the mandatory spending on electricity, gasoline, gas and food, this leads to the impoverishment of those who are already on the verge of poverty, turning them into beggars." Since the beginning of the year, member states of the European Union, including Italy, have been facing accelerating inflation, caused in part by Western sanctions against Russia. Most consumers consider inflation a top priority problem, given the growing food and energy prices and cuts in their spending power. According to Istat, Italy's National Statistics Agency, in mid-June, Italy hit a new record of around 5.6 million citizens living in absolute poverty, breaking the 2020 COVID-19 record of over 1 million citizens. The situation has been rapidly deteriorating in the country since then due to the growing annual inflation rate that hit a 36-year record high of 8.4% in August of this year. The Ritzau news website has more on the same story. Statistics Denmark reported Denmark's inflation rate has jumped to double digits for the first time in four decades, reaching 10% in September. According to the number-crunching agency, electricity and gas prices were once again primary factors behind the skyrocketing inflation in Denmark. The Danish Chamber of Commerce senior economist, Tore Stramer, described inflation as a result of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, with mutual restrictions imposed between EU and Russia, as well as a perfect storm of high demand following the COVID-19 crisis, supply chain problems, and an energy pinch. Denmark's central bank last month said rising inflation poses the biggest threat to the Danish economy, which it expects to shrink in the coming year. The central bank called on the government to dramatically tighten spending to avoid self-reinforcing wage price spiral. A similar pattern emerged in the fellow Nordic country Norway, which saw the biggest jump in food prices since the start of 1980s at 12.1%, while the overall inflation rate reached 6.9% in Norway in the month of September. Statistics Norway said they had to go back to 1988 to find a higher annual growth rate. DNB Markets chief economist Kjersti Holand told national broadcaster NRK the price pressure is stronger than expected, not just electricity but many goods and services as well. Economists said the high inflation rate indicates that the country's central bank must act harder and use more gunpowder to calm the Norwegian economy. Nordea Markets chief economist Yetil Olsen told Norway's national broadcaster NRK, this increases the probability of a new interest rate increase of 0.5 percentage point in November. Today's figures mean the central bank is far from finished raising interest rates. Norway's central bank has already raised the interest rate 3 times by 0.5 percentage point, expecting the price inflation to fall.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and how about listening to a gem of an advice from the model of magnanimity, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him? When you gain power over your adversary, pardon him by way of thanks for being able to overpower him.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, pleasure and perfection. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. In today's lesson, we're going to talk about pleasure and perfection. You're listening to A to Z program. I'm your host, Hossein Hinzano. Now, with a little consideration in his own being, each person can very clearly realize that he is by nature in search of pleasure. Happiness and comfort are also among the things that a person is always after during his life. And that he escapes from pain and agony. He's always trying hard to be away from any kind of pain and agony. Now, the indefatigable efforts and endeavors in life are for the purpose of, you know, enjoying more powerful and more enduring pleasures, and also of escaping from, or at least diminishing the pains or the agonies and the illnesses. When these coincide, they are compared. That is to say, slight pain and hardship is endured for being released from greater pain and affliction. And a human being can always not run away from such things so long as you are alive, so long as you're living this life. In this world of today, the world that's not complete, you are going to endure a good amount of pain and affliction. And a slight and limited pleasure is sacrificed for a greater and more enduring enjoyment. Now, likewise, enduring slight pain to reach a great and lasting pleasure and dispensing with a slight pleasure to be relieved of great pain are the requirements of man's reason and nature.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about pleasure and perfection as compared to, or as referred to, the human being. The insan. All rational functions are performed on the basis of these calculations. Differences seen in people with regard to, you know, preferring certain pleasures and pains are due to differences in discernment, mistakes in calculation, and other factors which will be discussed later. Now, from one angle, we can look at this from an angle. Pleasure is the motive behind activity and effort in life. And from another angle, it is the outcome and the result of this effort. From a final viewpoint, it can be regarded as perfection for sensible beings because it is an essential trait which human beings are apt to possess. An act which provides pleasure and drones pain away is desired and wanted, always wanted by the human being. Man likes and is fond of anything which is pleasurable to reach. Likewise, the term affection is used in the case of desirable deeds and traits. And this clears up the relationship among pleasure, determination, and affection. But it must be borne in mind that at times, man aspires for a specific pleasure, which of course requires a great deal of preparations, and as a result, he decides to carry out deeds each of which might be a preparation itself. In fact, the determination to carry out each of the deeds is a reflection of the genuine will accorded to performing the main deed. Man is always after the pleasure. Man is always running away from any type of pain or agony that he's going to face in life. He's after the pleasure for complicity, and he's running away of pain and agony in order to go near towards the complicity. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Until next episode, inshallah, we will meet again. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
So much joy can be found in a bottle of luxury perfume, but parting with hundreds of dollars for such scents, I can take the shine off that experience. Now in Syria, a perfumer is helping people smell expensive without digging too deep into their pockets. One whiff of a fragrance is all a Syrian perfumer needs to recreate the scents of luxury brands for a fraction of a cost. That's very welcome in a country ravaged by years of foreign-backed militancy. Dozens of customers flock daily to his tiny store nestled in the historic bazaar of Damascus. They flash photos on their phones of high-end perfumes they want to replicate. He says all he has is his nose.
Here lies the secret of the profession and the brain power. I started training my nose to smell perfumes since I was 15 years old. I do not own high-end equipment. All I have is my nose, my brain power and expertise. That's all.
In the war-torn country, many people struggle to afford life's bare necessities, let alone perfume. With the local currency losing much of its value, Syrian employees reportedly make roughly $25 a month, on average a quarter of the price of a bottle of imported perfume. This perfumer sells his fragrances for about $6, drawing in a flow of clients from all walks of life. Some people believe the internet will soon make paper books a thing of the past. In Iraq, book lovers are fighting back. They have launched a book festival offering thousands of free books to encourage the Arab nation to read more. The festival is called Iraq Reads. It's attracted big crowds. Iraqis stood shoulder to shoulder behind long tables covered in books and flipped through hundreds of titles to find the one catching their interest. Some others gather on next to the stands to read under a tree, chat about their newest books, or listen to extracts of literature read aloud through a loudspeaker. One of the organizers says they aim to revive the culture of reading books, reading paper books.
It's a crisis all over the world, not only in Iraq. There is a crisis in terms of reading paper books. One of the goals for our festival is to revive the reading of paper books so that the electronic book does not become an alternative of the paper book.
As part of the festival, 70,000 books have been distributed for free across the country so far. The books covering a wide range of topics were donated by partner libraries. The festival is held in seven provinces in the Arab country. You have probably seen penny farthings in old books and cartoons, the antique bicycle with one very large and one small wheel. Now, this peculiar bike actually brings fans together in Prague each year to show off their skills. The cyclists were all dressed in historical costumes as they rode in formation at Letno Park in Prague. The traditional one-mile race competition was also held to see who could go the fastest while keeping their balance. The riders, mostly elderly men, said they came there for just the fun of it. Penny farthings were invented around 1870 and were popular until models with two evenly sized wheels and chains were developed. Most bicycles today are based on this design. Egypt is marking 100 years since the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun, a pharaoh who ruled more than 1,300 years B.C.
I was fascinated with the story myself, and every morning in which I was here to pick up our inspector when I was working on a dig in the Valley of the Kings, I would wander around the house trying to imagine what it was like if I had been here in 1922 and could have been a part of that. And now here we are, now that it's restored. I do hope that this will turn into a center of cultural interest for anyone and everyone who wants to visit Egypt and wants to hear more of the story about Howard Carter and the king.
In 1922, British Egyptologist Howard Carter and his team discovered Tutankhamun's nearly intact tomb. That was the start of what became a 10-year project to excavate and conserve more than 5,000 unique artifacts. Tutankhamun's reign lasted barely 9 years in the vast span of ancient Egyptian history. Although his successors tried to erase the king's record from history, the valuable discovery of his tomb has immortalized the boy king.
China is taking the final step in the construction of its Tiangong space station, the second permanently inhabited station in low Earth orbit after NASA's International Space Station. The second and last lap component of the station was launched on Monday. The uncrewed module is called Mengtian, which means dreaming of the heavens. The rocket carrying it blasted off from China's Space Launch Center on the coast of the southern island province of Hainan. The 23-ton Mengtian is an advanced lab and does not have space for sleeping and sanitation. Instead, it has more space to carry payloads for scientific studies. Fan Ping is the chief designer of the project. She says this is a special step towards space research.
I think the Mengtian lab module is quite special, as it is for experiment only, which can be seen as a dedicated studio. There are 13 scientific experiment racks in the module and 37 exposed loading stations outside the module, enabling astronauts to do more extravehicular loading experiments in the future.
The Mengtian module is the last building block of the T-shaped Tiangong station. It has to fly 400 kilometers to join the two-module combination already dispatched into space. Together, the three modules will construct the station, which is designed for a lifespan of at least 10 years.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
It's always a tricky task to remember people's names at a party, but not in this particular gathering in Tokyo, where all the guests at the exact same name, Hirokazu Tanaka. 178 Hirokazu Tanakas came together on Saturday to set a new namesake gathering world record. Their ages spanned from 3 years old to 80. The Guinness World Record for the largest gathering of people with the same first and last name previously belonged to Martha Stewart. 164 people with that name came together in New York in 2005. In the Tanaka's gathering, every man was assigned an alias inspired by their hobbies, occupation, or favorite foods to tell them apart from others. One nicknamed by his birthplace says, "It's strange to meet so many people with the same name." Obviously.
It's a strange feeling to know that there are nearly 200 people with the same name. To be honest, I'd presume there are more popular names out there like Suzuki and Sato. This achievement is really because of the efforts of our organizer.
The man who organized this gathering is a 53-year-old Hirokazu Tanaka who has worked for years to make this happen. He says his quest began in 1994 when he stumbled upon news about a baseball prodigy with the same name. After that, he began tirelessly scouring the nation for his namesakes. He then founded the Hirokazu Tanaka campaign that brought the men together and created a strange friendship among them. Thousands of baby turtles have been released into Peru's Amazon basin in an attempt to preserve the rainforest ecosystem. More than 6,000 hatchlings of three endangered species of turtles have been released into lakes and lagoons in Peru to help them repopulate. To make this happen, wildlife officials collected the eggs from their natural habitat and transferred them to artificial beaches until they hatched. The river turtles are considered vulnerable because for many years they have been killed for human consumption or kept as pets. Scientists are currently trying to conserve the Amazon to avoid catastrophic climate change, and Peru has the second largest share of the rainforest after Brazil. Another world record news. This time it has been set in Switzerland. A Swiss railway company has run the world's longest passenger train with a trip on one of the most spectacular tracks through the Alps. To celebrate its 175th anniversary, Switzerland's rail industry launched the world's longest ever passenger train, measuring around 2 kilometers. The electric train took almost an hour to cover around 25 kilometers over the UNESCO World Heritage Albula Line in eastern Switzerland. The Albula Line is famous for its endless swooping curves and steep descents. Rail enthusiasts lined the valley to watch the train's 100 cars snake through the Alps. Belgium and the Netherlands were the previous record holders for the world's longest passenger train. They used standard railway through the flat landscapes.
If you enjoy street art, then you'll probably like Iztapalapa district in Mexico's capital city. Nearly 300 neighborhoods in this area are beautifully painted with brightly colored murals for all to enjoy. Visitors can also ride a cable car and take a tour of the art from above. The district is home to nearly 7,000 murals and graffiti painted on all sorts of surfaces, including rooftops. Iztapalapa Murals is a project that was promoted by the Mexico City's mayor in 2018. The goal of the project was to recover and dignify public spaces through art and involve neighbors in its creation and conservation. Iztapalapa is one of the poorest municipalities in the capital, and the initiative aims to reduce neighborhood violence through public lighting of the murals during the night.
It is never too late to learn a new skill. That's what 100-year-old Nada Rudan has shown with her art when she discovered her love for painting at the age of 87. The Bosnian native says she started to paint to keep herself busy, and now she finds the days are often too short to fit in everything she wanted to do. The artist paints for 3 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon without glasses. Rudan marked her 100th birthday with an exhibition of all the works that she has painted over the years.
My 100th birthday, I've celebrated it at sea. That was really a big event for me. Before that, I had an exhibition that I didn't hope for. But my children persuaded me. I was against it. I'm not an artist. I said, children, don't embarrass me.
She says she's inspired by nature and her travel around the globe. Rudan has lived in numerous areas such as Central America, Hawaii Islands, Europe, and the Asian Himalayas, among many other places. The artist survived both World War II and the siege of Sarajevo by Bosnian Serb forces.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States of America, or as what the publication Economist has described, that this United States of America is on the path to decline. This is what experts have acknowledged and had warned years before. From its broken economy to its political division and decadent culture, there is no glimpse of hope for the U.S. to be recovered. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Guardian, in an article, noted the United States is a textbook example of a country headed towards civil war. The trends increasingly point one way, while nobody knows the future, little, if anything, is being done by anyone to try to prevent the collapse of the republic. Belief in democracy is ebbing. The legitimacy of institutions is declining. America increasingly is entering a state where its citizens don't want to belong to the same country. These are conditions ripe for political violence. No civil war ever has a single cause. It's always a multitude of factors that lead to decline and collapse. The current U.S. has several of what the CIA calls threat multipliers. Environmental crises continue to batter the country. Economic inequality is at the highest level since the founding of the country. And demographic change means that the U.S. will be a minority white country within just over two decades. All of these factors tend to contribute to civil unrest wherever they are found in the world. But the U.S. is more vulnerable to political violence than any other countries because of the discrepancies of institutions. For 40 years, trust in institutions of all kinds, the church, the police, journalism, academia, has been in free fall. Trust in politicians can hardly fall any lower. And there is no reason for trust. The Constitution, while unquestionably a work of genius, was a work of 18th century genius. It simply does not reflect, nor can it respond to, the realities of the 21st century. The divide between the American political system and any reflection of the popular will is widening, and increasingly it cannot be ignored. The electoral college system means that in the near term, a Democrat will win the popular mandate by many millions of votes and still lose the presidency. The crisis of democracy will only grow. With around 345 election deniers on the ballot as candidates in November, the Republicans appear to have evolved a new political strategy, seemingly based on the gambling strategy of Joe Pesci's character in Casino. If they win, they collect. The American electoral system is already hugely localized, outdated, and held together by good faith. Any failure to recognize electoral outcomes, even in a few states, should result in a contested election in which nobody reaches the threshold of 270 electoral college votes. In that case, the Constitution stipulates a contingent election. And acclimatize yourself to this phrase now, in which each state gets a single vote. That's right. If no candidate in an American presidential election reaches the threshold of 270 electoral college votes, the House delegations from individual states, overwhelmingly dominated by Republicans, pick the president, with each state having one vote. In 1824, the candidate who won the popular vote and the most electoral college votes, Andrew Jackson, did not become president. John Quincy Adams fought his way through. A contingent election is one mechanism, just one, by which an American government could be perfectly constitutional and completely undemocratic at the same time. The right has been preparing for exactly such a reality for a while, with a phrase they repeat as if in hope that it will mean something if they say it enough. We are a republic, not a democracy. Quasi-legitimacy is what leads to violence, and America's political institutions are destined to become more and more quasi-legitimate from now on. One of the surest markers of incipient civil war in other countries is the legal system devolving from a nonpartisan, truly national institution to a spoil of partisan war. That has already happened in the U.S. America is rushing headlong into another civil war, and it's a matter of when, not if. As political scientist Professor Barbara F. Walker argues, civil wars are likely in the presence of two factors, autocracy and ethnic factionalism. When one considers the centrality of race to American politics, it is clear that ethno-nationalism is hastening the movement towards autocracy. Think about the role of race in the first civil war and the one we are headed towards. It's well documented that the repulsive nature of the institution of slavery was the principal cause of the civil war, driven by moral as well as economic and political concerns. In the 19th century America, the Democratic Party was a relatively reactionary institution in the South, whereas the Republican Party was a relatively progressive institution located in the North. Republicans supported the abolition of slavery, whereas the 19th century Democrats were all for it. Regardless of the outcome of the war, driven as it was by the prospect of material gain or loss, moral redemption or immorality, the war came to rest on the fulcrum of race and racism. Throughout history, political identity in the U.S. has ultimately been driven by the party's respective positions on race, with divisions sorting primarily by the way of racial identity and racial attitudes. Contemporary Republicans, for instance, tend to be white and relatively racist. Democrats are more likely to draw from a more diverse pool and, as such, are typically